Today's session started with me returning to the fact that obviously we live right now in a moment of great challenge for American Christianity and American democracy. And with some wondering, I think, does this kind of polarization, this kind of hyper-polarization within the churches go all the way back? And I spoke at some length about the fact that for the last generation or so, histories of modern American Protestantism could easily give one the impression that they do, in fact, go all the way back. Histories of American Protestant life from the Civil War to the present over the last generation have often told the story as one of an unfolding epic battle between two diametrically opposed camps. On the one side were the stalwart defenders of the old-time religion, committed to championing historic Christian faith, even and sometimes especially those parts of it that had fallen out of favor in the modern world. On the other side in this story are the liberal, some say secularizing, modernists, who were purportedly willing to jettison any and all specific articles of faith if it meant ending up with a Christianity more relevant, or at the very least more palatable to contemporary audiences. So I talked at some length about this story that that historians have told in recent decades about kind of this epic battle between conservative defenders of the old-time religion and modernists who are willing to update and accommodate Christianity to the times, through the course of a number of different kind of heresy trials, through the course of late 19th century and early 20th century battles over Darwinism and the authority of Scripture. You know, we have this story, obviously, of if you've ever seen Inherit the Wind, this classic film, you know that one of the key plot points in this would-be story of kind of an unfolding epic battle unfolds in Dayton, Tennessee in the 1920s in what's been called the Scopes Monkey Trial, which featured free-thinking attorney Clarence Darrow squaring off against one of the nation's most famous politicians and most famous fundamentalists, William Jennings Bryan. And in the traditional story that's been told, this is a story about how Bryan won the trial but really lost the cultural battle, was humiliated by Darrow, and as the story goes, conservative Protestants go into full-fledged retreat. Though, after the trial in Dayton, there was an ongoing fight here at First Presbyterian Church, now Nassau Presbyterian Church in Princeton, and over at Princeton Seminary. And really the fight here in the late 1920s was between conservatives. So someone like J. Gresham Machen, who was the supply preacher here at Nassau in the early 1920s, and who was the author of a book called Christianity and Liberalism, that argued that there could be no compromise between conservatives and liberals because the latter, in his view, had invented an entirely different religion. Quote, only the more destructive of the Christian faith, Machen insisted, because it makes use of traditional Christian terminology. There were others on the Princeton Seminary faculty and here at Nassau Church who said, hey, you know, J. Gresham Machen, I'm with you on theological questions, but I also think that those who are more liberal than I am are also part of this kind of big tent Presbyterian Christian world that we're building together. And so where the recording picks up is at this moment where the folks like Machen and folks like Charles Erdman, his colleague on the Princeton Seminary faculty, a fellow conservative, but who's in dialogue with liberal Protestant Christians. You know, it picks up, the recording does, in the middle of this kind of fight between the Machens and the Urbans of the world about whether or not how big the tent of American Protestantism really could be headed into the key cultural fights of the mid-20th century. With that, I'll let you pick up with the recording.
Urban's views, the differences between colleagues were not theological, but rather questions of, quote, spirit, methods, or policies. This division would be of no consequence, he went on, were it not for the unkindness, suspicion, bitterness, and intolerance of those members of the faculty who are also editors of the Presbyterian, this journal. Only one person fit the bill, J. Gresham Machen. Later that same year, Erdman was nominated to be moderator of the General Assembly. Machen and several of Erdman's colleagues on the Princeton Seminary faculty published a pamphlet setting forth why he should not be elected moderator of the General Assembly. And in May, right before the assembly meeting, Machen declared, quote, Dr. Erdman, despite his personal orthodoxy, this is also key, had the plaudits of the enemies of the gospel. It was a most revealing statement. The differences between Machen and Erdmann had little to do with doctrine. They were not, on the one hand, a fundamentalist and on the other, a modernist. They were both conservatives. Their differences revolved around how big the denominational Presbyterian Church and institutional Princeton Seminary tents should be. You may know the rest of the story. The vision for a bigger tent at Princeton Theological Seminary prevailed. By 1926, the faculty was truly hopelessly divided. Even making matters worse, the institution had two boards of directors at the time, a board of directors and a board of trustees. They were also divided. And so in 1929, the General Assembly intervened, merging the two boards, strengthening the office of the president, inviting all faculty to stay. Machen and a number of his allies left to found Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. Epic battles, indeed. There's no question that the framing of the whole history of modern American Protestantism around conflict between two diametrically opposed camps makes for good storytelling. And it can also help to shed some light on the deeper roots of our hyper-polarized contemporary moment. The problem, in my view, is that this way of framing the history of modern American Protestantism is just wrong. Because the much bigger story throughout this whole period that I've just been narrating, and even after, throughout the late 19th and most of the 20th centuries, the one that should be the leading headline in our histories of this whole period, is about the construction of a big tent Protestant coalition that sought to hold together historic Christian faith and the pursuit of a more just society. That's the big story, I think. We've focused on these really fun and dramatic conflicts, but I think we've gotten distracted in some sense by them as well. In the early 20th century, the members of this broad-based coalition often self-identified. This is where it gets a little confusing, so hold on to your questions and we can come back to these. They often self-identified as evangelical. That's the word that they use to describe themselves. If you read, some of you I know have read Harry Emerson Fosdick's sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win? And he uses the term evangelical to describe himself and the churches of which he's a part. At the mid-20th century, a very different coalition emerged within American Protestantism, laying claim to that term. And so by the 1960s, the folks who once called themselves evangelical started calling themselves mainline. So it gets a little confusing. So in our contemporary parlance, and this is, I think, key. It's one of my soapboxes. Mainline today is often used interchangeably with liberal. So the mainline churches or liberal Protestantism. I think that's just wrong, at least historically. I mean, there may be a better argument for it right now than there has been in the past. Part of what I want to argue today is that for a long time, one of the defining features of this evangelical turned mainline coalition was its commitment to a big tent, not to being partisan and narrow. In fact, that was the actual core, the crux of the disagreement between the folks in this tent and the folks outside of it. Liberals like Harry Emerson Fosdick and conservatives like Charles Erdmann didn't agree on any number of theological questions. But they, in stark contrast with someone like Machen, nevertheless regarded one another as fellow Christians who could best serve God and neighbor if they found ways to hang together. Fosdick declared in his famous 1922 sermon, this was preached 100 years ago this past spring, Shall the Fundamentalist Win?, quote, is not the Christian church large enough to hold within her hospitable fellowship people who differ on points like this and agree to differ until the fuller truth be manifested? This sermon is often in the traditional story used as this is the champion of the liberals. But throughout the sermon, Fosdick makes clear over and over again that he has many friends who are conservatives, and he regards the conservatives as a genuine, legitimate partner in the building out and an ongoing mission of the quote-unquote evangelical churches. So this is what I want to kind of lay out today, is that part of how we should think about the mainline is not as one partisan side of this epic unfolding battle, but rather of the main line as a kind of unwieldy, interdenominational Protestant tent. And part of what I want to think about with you, I'll start today and then into the next 2 weeks as we look at kind of the history of this tradition's engagement in public life. I think the challenges of the main line and its public witness emerge directly out of the fact that it wasn't a kind of homogeneous partisan entity, but rather very big and very unwieldy, and that is tough. So part of what I want to think about, especially next week, but we can start to talk about it maybe even today, is about how the tent is constructed. Who had power within the tent, and how? What were the kind of rules of engagement within it? How would you determine within this big, unwieldy tent when it was possible, when it was necessary to say something prophetic? And how could you, when within the tent there was an impossibly diverse mix of opinions? So I want to start thinking about some of these challenges today, and I want to direct our sort of attention to an organization that's a helpful window into these dynamics, the Federal Council of Churches. Its successor organization, the National Council of Churches, is still around, but the Federal Council of Churches emerges in 1908, and it's this kind of ecumenical body that has two main goals in mind, and they really embody in many ways kind of the spirit and the hopes of this mainline big tent coalition. Its two goals were to underscore the unity of the churches, especially the Protestant churches in the United States. This is a kind of deep conviction that part of what these churches needed to do was to kind of mount a unified public witness. And relatedly, the hope of the Federal Council was to bolster Protestant efforts to reform American society, to create a society more just, more faithful. FCC, from the very beginning, very big tent, very unwieldy. At its founding, it included 33 denominations. By design, a select group of large, predominantly white, self-identifying evangelical, in that older sense, churches, the ones that we would now call the mainline, wielded most of the power within the organization. But the FCC included a variety of smaller denominations too, the Society of Friends, the Moravian Church, the Reformed Church in America, as well as four, and this is key, of the nation's leading black denominations, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Zion Church, the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church, and the National Baptist Convention. So what this means, and this is what we'll see as we kind of move forward in thinking about kind of this tradition's engagement in public life, is that power within the tent was nowhere near equally distributed, but the tent was nevertheless very capacious. It housed northern black progressives such as Ida B. Wells, Adam Clayton Powell, and Nannie Burroughs, arch-conservative white southerners and segregationists in the Southern Presbyterian and Southern Methodist Church, Christian socialists such as Vita Scudder and Reverdy Ransom, architects of the New Deal such as Frances Perkins, the first ever woman member of the cabinet and the labor secretary for all of FDR's presidency. The tent also encompassed not just Frances Perkins, an architect of the New Deal, but some of the New Deal's state's most formidable religious critics, including James Fifield, a congregational pastor who was an integral figure in the emergence of a kind of libertarian Christian gospel of free enterprise in the mid-20th century. It included folks who were theologically all over the map, from folks like B.B. Warfield to the most liberal and with countless moderating positions in between. This is a big tent, if ever there was one. But it wasn't without limits. The FCC didn't claim any authority over its member denominations. It was kind of a voluntary sort of thing. But it did require them to affirm Jesus Christ as, quote, divine Lord and Savior. This was a minimalistic theological test, but one that excluded the Unitarians, who really wanted to be in. They really wanted to join, and they were not allowed. Other denominations were really averse to joining the FCC and never did. Many Lutheran groups weren't interested in being a part of this ecumenical coalition. The Southern Baptists Fascinatingly, I mean, the FCC really wanted the Southern Baptists in, and the Southern Baptists would not join. Pentecostal and Holiness churches opted out for the most part of this ecumenical group. And then you had denominations that came and went, and sometimes they came and went again. The Southern Presbyterians were constantly, and we'll get into this a lot more next week, Southern Presbyterians are constantly conflicted about whether they can really be a part of this thing, because they're really angry about a lot of the positions that the Federal Council would end up taking. But on the other hand, they, on principle, wanted to be a part of this thing for the reasons I mentioned, that they in some sense shared a commitment to church unity and a commitment to a kind of better society in the way that they understood it, even as they found that they often were at odds with the council's public witness. So the FCC, right, this kind of public ecumenical body that is in some sense a kind of lived embodiment of how the mainline at the beginning of the 20th century understands itself as one of the key factors shaping American public life. And the FCC structure reflected its ambitions. It had committees, lots of committees, committees on all sorts of things, on literature and education, on temperance, on family, on Sunday observance, on foreign missions, on home missions, on peace and arbitration, on relations with Japan, on the church and country life, on the church and social service, and on evangelism. That last one galvanized by Princeton Seminary alum and librarian William Roberts, one of the conservatives in the Presbyterian Church who was very much committed to this ecumenical body. Now, not every sort of FCC officer, let alone every member denomination, was as excited about every one of these commissions as the other, but together they reflected the very different kinds of impulses that animated the work of the Council, which by the end of World War I was widely recognized as the single most influential religious organization in the country. Not even close. None of these commissions put the Council's big tent to the test like that on the church and social service. Not surprising, perhaps. Its purview, this particular council committee's purview, discerning and enacting the gospel's implications for public life, was from the very beginning recognized as absolutely essential to the organization's overall mission. I don't know if you can see this, but one of the very first things that the Federal Council did in 1908 was to adopt what it called a social creed of the churches, in which it took stands on a variety of hot-button issues. They weren't the strongest stands in every case because, again, it was a big tent and lots of different points of view. So none of the positions that the Federal Council staked out would have been the most progressive or the most radical. But it stood for things like, quote, equal rights and complete justice for all men in all stations of life, for the abolition of child labor, for such regulation of the conditions of toil for women as shall safeguard the physical and moral health of the community, for a six-day work week, for a living wage, for the abatement of poverty, and more. The Council's earliest promotional materials also reflected this kind of social emphasis, which was really close to the heart of the matter, and that emphasis would only grow over time. By the 1920s, the FCC was purporting to represent the churches of Christ, quote unquote, at high-level tables alongside representatives of the nation's leading Catholic and Jewish advocacy organizations. The FCC waded into all kinds of public questions, ranging from prohibition to race relations to unemployment to labor disputes to prison and jail reform and beyond. Its leaders of this commission were engaged in high-level conversations at the White House. They were engaged in lots of addresses to local churches and to regional bodies. And this activity would only grow during the 1930s and during the economic emergency of the Great Depression. By that point in time, as I said, the FCC had really become kind of could sit at the table and really claim to represent, in some sense, these really large and influential Protestant church bodies. And so it was no surprise that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, very soon after being inaugurated president of the United States, would come to the FCC's annual meeting. It's a 25th anniversary meeting. Congratulate the organization on, quote, creating a much needed union that seeks to better the social and moral conditions of all the people of America. FCC developed, and this is getting to some of the kind of expected conflict, a close working relationship with the leaders of the of FDR's administration. A lot of the FCC leaders were actually Republicans, and a large percentage of their constituencies certainly would have been Republican. But the organization staunchly supported most aspects of the New Deal, including groundbreaking pro-labor legislation, as well as the Social Security Act. It did so while touting itself as nonpartisan and altogether non-threatening. But many were not convinced. It was one thing when the bombs were lobbed by fundamentalists outside the organization, those kind of sectarians who had had no interest from the very beginning in this big Protestant tent. One detractor in the course of reviewing a book that insisted that the Federal Council was under the influence of the Third Internationale and was, quote, seeking to destroy all churches and to stifle all religion. Sort of a laughable claim in many ways, but one that underscores these kinds of claims, these kinds of debates are not new in our time. The reviewer went on to comment, quote, this powerful organization is a dreadful menace to true Christianity. And this image reflects the kind of, especially as you head to the 1930s, the Federal Council, there's a concerted effort led by folks like James Fifield and others to brand the Federal Council as un-American and as, communist, red, socialist, radical, not truly Christian. So one thing when those criticisms come from the outside, I'm going to try to end here shortly, so I think there's a lot to talk about here. It was much harder to dismiss these kinds of criticisms when they came from within and around the FCC's own circles, and they often did. One of the main duties of the organization's leadership was to make sure that even as they made attempts to offer a bold public witness, that the big tent that they were also trying to sustain didn't collapse. One New York pastor whose church belonged to the council wrote in the 1930s to explain why he could no longer personally support it, mainly because in his view, the council only represented, quote, the left wing of the church. This is the kind of critique that was coming, you know, fast and furious in the 1930s. The general secretary replied with a letter and pamphlet attempting to show why that was, quote, a wrong impression, when an Alabama businessman relayed his feeling that the FCC was, quote, entirely too friendly to the enemies of the private enterprise system. The general secretary responded by stressing how much he had enjoyed the chance to attend a recent meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers, and how he found himself, quote, in full accord with every word, unquote, which the president of the organization had uttered in his speech. He closed the letter, quote, I should like also to mention the fact that the primary emphasis in the council's program today is upon Christian evangelism and strengthening the foundations of American life. So part of what, and I want to end and open this up, part of my contention as we kind of, if we end this chronological story in the middle of these the 1930s and the New Deal years, part of what's emerging and is one of the big stories of the 20th century mainline is a conflict between, on the one hand, a desire to offer a kind of bold public witness on vital public questions, with, on the other hand, a desire to find a way, somehow, amid offering a bold public witness on vital public questions, to hold together the most unwieldy possible tent of disagreement. And that fight, that which the leaders of the FCC, the leaders of the mainline denominations, are in some sense all deeply engaged in trying to balance as you head into this period of great turmoil in the 1930s, would only intensify. And this is where I want to pick up my part of the story next week, ending here momentarily today, in the fight over civil rights. This fight over civil rights, which would put maximal pressure on the one hand, thanks to the grassroots efforts of civil rights activists, there could be no avoiding, as sometimes the leaders of the Federal Council had hoped to be able to do, there could be no avoiding a clear stand on questions of civil rights. And there could also be no avoiding the fact that a clear stand on civil rights was almost certain to blow up this big tent Protestant coalition as it careened into the 1950s and 1960s. So I want to think about that story today, next week, but just set it up today by trying to, again, reframe the history of the main line and its role in American public life, not as one partisan in an epic battle between modernists and fundamentalists, but rather as the big tent trying to hold together these big theological and political fights heading into, and they're getting bigger as we head into the mid-20th century. So all in there, we've got, I think, 15 minutes for conversation, and I know we need to have mics. So as you have questions, or hopefully we have time for some good just discussion, please raise your hand and make sure you have a mic before you start talking. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Right by you there, Marshall. The woman right in front of you, I think, has a... Yeah.
Thank you, Professor. Good morning, everybody. Happy Sunday. I'm not an American, but it's very interesting to learn about the many factors outside the churches that influence the churches as well as themselves. And you describe how social scientists came into the being of American society. And then in the Depression, you bring the political influence into the church. And so I think like there has been missing since the beginning how politics has been influenced that you didn't describe. What happened in this social science enter into American society? What was the politic that influenced in the process that bring to this red into the Federal Council of Churches?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So if I understand your question, I mean, I would say, you know, American Protestants have been engaged in politics going all the way back to the beginning of the nation before. And more than that, have had a sense often of themselves as, and this has deep roots in kind of the history of the American state, as kind of the guardians of the nation. But they also often haven't agreed. And so sometimes this coalition, I mean, in some sense, what I'm describing here is the main line as an attempt to kind of pull together. In the 19th century, you have this vast Protestant coalition that in some sense is, I think if you read, you know, literature on the pre-Civil War years, in some ways is more important in shaping public life than the federal government is, actually. These denominations have such an outsized role in shaping public life in the U.S. The coalition totally fractures, obviously, in the Civil War. And part of the story of the main line is an attempt to kind of bring that coalition back together. But there's longstanding deep disagreements, even as churches feel the need to weigh in on public questions and on political questions, they can't presume agreement. And so that's part of the dynamic that's very much like kind of at the heart of the history of American Christianity is it's very deeply tied to the history of the American state. Those are like perennial fights. Yeah.
How long did they adhere to the 1908 adoption of those things you listed?
Yeah. They're still on the books. In fact, in 1933, they update in the middle of this New Deal kind of flurry, the Federal Council revisits its 1908 social creed and says, we can actually take stronger positions. And they do. So in 1930, early 30s, they revise the social creed. It's at the same moment when the Vatican revisits its 40 years after Rerum Novarum, which was a very important Catholic statement on labor questions in 1891. 1931, the Vatican revisits that and promulgates a new encyclical, updating its kind of stance on labor questions. And right around the same moment, the Federal Council updates its thing and takes kind of harder, more particular stances on these sorts of social questions. So yeah, they're still technically, I mean, a guiding kind of document for the National Council of Churches today. Yeah. Yes, okay, we got lots of hands coming up. Yep.
Hi. Could you be more specific about why the Lutherans and the Southern Baptists refused to join?
Yeah. I mean, there's a complicated response to that. I mean, I think, you know, the Lutherans in this period are immigrant churches, many of them still holding worship in European languages. They have both probably principled and also just pragmatic ways in which they don't feel as comfortable or as much a part of this big Protestant coalition that goes back and has kind of a sense of itself as custodian of the nation. In some sense, most of the Lutheran churches didn't have that same sort of history to feel a part of that. The Southern Baptists are skeptical, I mean, in their own ways, I think, of big church government. I mean, that's essential to the Southern Baptist way, right? They don't really have, in some ways, it's a denomination, but that has very little in the way of denominational authority or power. And so the idea of joining a body that's above the denomination that has any kind of ability to speak on its behalf would make, I think, Southern Baptists very nervous. It's not only because of the kind of theological or cultural politics, because their friends in the Southern Methodists and Southern Presbyterians are part of the council, but they just have a different sense of polity. I think that's a big factor there. Yep. Okay. Davida, and then let's come here. Yeah, after that.
So I find it interesting that as a church, big church,
yeah,
we frequently put out these calls for unity, mm-hmm, and then we weaponize that unity, mm-hmm, saying things like, if you're really a Christian, you wouldn't this, X, Y, Z, and especially over social issues, we frequently weaponize faith against or for social, mm-hmm, calls for social justice.
Yeah. I mean, this is a perennial tension. I mean, so this thing that, I think what's interesting in my view about this moment, you know, if we're kind of looking back at the fundamentalist modernist controversy as it's known, I mean, one of the core convictions of the folks on the left in that controversy is that the folks on the right are legitimately part of the thing, even if they have deep disagreements on theological questions.
This is, again, I think it's essential. I think this is the big story of the mainline, is that the question of, is it even possible to hang together in the midst of social, political, cultural, spiritual turmoil? And I think one of the questions, I had a conversation a few weeks ago with two pastors and a bishop about these very issues today. So, I mean, that's something you might be interested in if you're interested in that question. And the bishop and one of the pastors got into this fascinating exchange where the bishop is the first openly queer bishop of the United Methodist Church. And she was talking about how she profoundly laments the departure of the conservatives from the Methodist Church, though she has experienced great scorn from that party. And then a pastor who was sort of saying that the church should be a place of unity and not difference around these kinds of social political questions, because the church needs to be a refuge. And they got into a fascinating exchange about who bears the cost of unity, but also what are we even trying to do if we can't in some sense find a way to hang together in the midst of these divided times? So this is tough stuff that is already tough then and remains tough today. Okay.
Can you just tell us where someone could find that conversation?
Yes. It is, I'm trying to think about what the best way to describe it. We might be able to send it out. You can find it if you go to the seminary website.
I'm also moderating a series of conversations at the seminary this year on the future of American democracy. So if you sign up, you can get a if you sign up your email, you'll get a link to all of the materials. There's a bunch of kind of unfolding conversations, and that one I think is very relevant to this discussion.
That's ptsem.edu, yep. And search Future of American Democracy.
Yep. I think right here we had a...
Thank you, by the way, for the excellent talk. Yep. And it seems to me, and I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, that America is almost uniquely drenched in religious thought as part of its popular thought and intellectual thought. I mean, all of our great in Europe, you had, you know, Hegel kicking Kant and lobbing quills at each other, and people would say, "I've got sheep to take care of, you know, let them fight." Not here. We have a great awakening long before what you're talking about. Going, people cared about this, and it was the mixture of social, church, and theological change, and intellectual change were all sort of together and from our very beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that the separatism is sort of a natural outflow of that, or is that?
Well, I mean, as I was saying in response to the first question, I mean, in some sense, one of the big stories of, and one of the more surprising features of U.S. history and of the history of American Christianity, at the outset, as I showed you that chart that I put up at the very beginning last week, you know, the colonial period, not a period of great investment in Christian institutions. And then the United States Constitution, you know, the Bill of Rights, like, disestablishes debated way, church and state, which is completed at the state level by 1833. And so for a lot of observers looking on in the beginning of the 19th century, I mean, there's a real question about, does Christianity have a future? But when Alexis de Tocqueville comes to the United States in the mid-19th century, he looks at the United States and says, this thing which has struck sociologists and historians alike, I think, for generations, which is, wow, Christianity and democracy are tied together here in a way that we don't see in these older European societies where there's been a state church. And so part of the interaction of Christianity and democracy as kind of a perennial feature, vastly important feature, and it's important in for better or for worse to the present day, right? That these two things, there's a kind of consciousness, there's a fusion. I mean, Mark Knoll talks about in his book, America's God, that there's a kind of fusion of a kind of Protestant evangelicalism and American nationalism at the very dawn of the Republic. And that, you know, in some sense, has never entirely left us. So we're stuck with the challenges of that as well as the opportunities. Yeah.
I don't know if this is... you're able to do this at this point, but how is scripture being used in this discussion, the separation from this Federal Council of Churches and the Federal Council of Church members? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is, where do the Catholics fit in on this? I know they're being marginalized over a lot of theology, but yet there's some great Catholic social interventions, really self-sacrificial ones.
Yeah.
And
How
does that all fit in?
Yeah, I think I can take those both relatively straightforward. I mean, I think the Bible's being used on all sides of these debates. It's being used by the Federal Council and its leadership. Harold Ickes, who's the secretary of something, I can't remember off the top of my head, in the New Deal, goes to the PCUSA annual, you know, general conference, and talks about the New Deal as the realization of the Sermon on the Mount. Even as folks on the other side, James Fifield and others, are using scripture to say this has no place. These are red communist structures that are being built. So that's the case. This is a very interesting moment. The moment that I just ended at today is a moment where the Catholic Church is really still faces significant prejudice in American public life. Al Smith, 1928, his Catholic faith is a big factor in his failure to win the presidency. But also that this is a moment when the Federal Council and leaders of the kind of leading Catholic and Jewish organizations are also starting to partner together in the 1920s. And that partnership will be really key moving into the civil rights era. So there is a sense, a growing sense among the leadership of the Federal Council, at least, that Catholics are important, maybe still in their view, kind of junior partners in imagining kind of what the right way forward is for the United States. We have time for another question? Yeah, okay, yeah.
Along the line of the questioning here in the Big Tent, just conceptually, if you have someone whose theology and concept of the church is primarily inclusive, and then on the other hand, someone whose theology is primarily exclusive.
Yeah.
So how do those two bodies come together? I think that's what we're experiencing here. And then also, I can see how the exclusive group would not want to be a part of that. But then the sort of a separate question too is like, for those that are more inclusive, can you be inclusive and say, I'm inclusive, but I want to exclude you because you're being exclusive? Is that truly inclusive? So, yeah. I don't know, I'm just...
Yeah, no, that is the exact thing. That, I mean, this is what I'm most interested in. This is kind of the crux of what I would argue, is that Charles Erdman, here at Princeton Seminary, and Fosdick, and these kind of leading lights of the inclusive party, as you're calling it rightly, I think, they see Machen and the conservatives and even the fundamentalists. Now they have huge disagreements with them, and they're not afraid to talk about those disagreements. And part of what Fosdick talks about in this famous sermon is all of his many disagreements with the conservative. But his real problem is that the fundamentalists, unlike the conservatives, he makes a distinction there, that the fundamentalists refuse to even hear him out because they've already, I mean, this is Machen's thing in Christianity and Liberalism in 1923, that liberal Christianity isn't Christianity. And it's actually, and this is, I mean, you can see this in contemporary conversation as well, right? Machen finds it, as he says, that quote I read, right, that it's more dangerous because it's purporting to be Christianity, but it's not Christianity. And so this is the fundamental dividing line. So there's lots of conservatives who share most of Machen's theological convictions in the main line and in the Federal Council. And there are conservatives in those denominations that are affiliated with the Federal Council, now the National Council, into the present day. I mean, this is part of my thing here, right? Is that the Methodists right now are enduring a kind of split in 2022 down these sorts of lines. And so the idea that, you know, we've been told that in 1920s there was a great divorce, that doesn't, by my lights, kind of make sense of what the reality is. And so part of what I think is true is that in the main line, and you can see this in the Federal Council of Churches General Secretary correspondence, right? He will take every conservative. He is delighted. He's actively campaigning to keep conservatives inside the tent. So, you know, whereas on the other hand, you know, Machen and his lights see, I mean, already, you know, in 1912, I think, I can end with, do I have time to tell one story? Okay, brief. Walter Rauschenbusch, famous preacher of the social gospel, hears from one of his students that Riley up in Minnesota, fundamentalist preacher up in Minnesota, has been telling his revival audiences that Rauschenbusch is not a true Christian. And so this is what's so interesting to me. Rauschenbusch actually writes Riley a letter and says, hey, I've heard you've been saying this from my students. Is this true? And Riley writes him back and says, yeah, it is true, and I think you're not a Christian. And Rauschenbusch writes back this 3-page letter that says, I am more of a Christian in many ways than you are. And I deeply, deeply hold to kind of, again, the main line, trying to hold together historic Christian faith in some important sense with a fight for a better society and folks who are outside of the tent saying, yeah, we think you've just given up on Christianity. So that fight will intensify headed into civil rights era. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Heath.
So please join us next week as Dr. Carter continues the series and we focus on civil rights.
Civil rights.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you all. No. Yeah. Yeah.